Anyway, so I'm Tali Tishbi, and I was asked to give a seminar a little early in this my relatively long period here, and there are many things I could talk about. I wanted to talk about something which directly bears on neuroscience and maybe even analysis of experiments. And I hope that there are sufficiently many experimentalists here to appreciate it. But so this is a work, an ongoing work, which is done mainly by my excellent student Amir Globusson at the Hebrew University, and in close collaboration with the lab of Elon Vardia, who, as many of you know, is doing motor neurophysiology. And there's a lot of synergy, and probably some redundancy as well, between the groups and the way we think about the data. So this is actually almost the first time since we started to collaborate. I'm trying to gain some time, as you can see. Since we started to collaborate, that we actually planned experiments together and thought about the method of analysis before the experiments are performed. Because usually what happens is that we get the data after it was well digested and published, and try to get something out of it which was not done immediately by the experimentalist. And it's still not here, but I think we are starting to get to the point that experimentalists actually appreciate, even in the design of the experiments, what can actually be extracted from the measurements. Now, so what I want to present here is really some sort of another view of this theme of information theoretic analysis of neuroscience data, and it has actually is directly related to some of the things we heard during the 2 weeks that I'm here, and I guess even before that, and especially to the work of Bill Bialik and some of his students, of course, and actually you're going to see this, and others like Peter Latham and Alexander Treves and others who use information theory to quantify redundancy and synergy and other things in the data. And so we are trying to propose a slightly, maybe even a fundamentally different approach to this problem of using mutual information, which should address some of the main criticism of people, especially experimentalists, against mutual information, mainly the inability to estimate it properly, and the fact that you usually don't have enough data to say anything, and there are other simpler measures like, you know, correlations or things like this, which are much easier, much simpler to estimate. And the question is really, what do you gain, or what can you gain by thinking about mutual information? So we want to propose a way which we call, which is actually related to a philosophy which generalizes ideas like, you know, maximum entropy and things like this, which we call minimum information estimation or minimum information estimation for learning. It's actually a principle of inference, first of all, and it bears on some even deeper issues which are really at the heart of information theory, which is not just thinking about mutual information as a function that quantifies independence or something like this, as many of you tend to think of, but actually as a generating function, as a functional that generates some of the key issues in information theory. And I'll say very little about it. If there is more interest, I can address it maybe sometime later in this month or next month, I don't know. What we can achieve by this, by bounding the information in population, essentially looking at data again, what can we say about a population of neurons by measurements of a few, really a few neurons here and there, often not even in the same experiment, I think is a fundamental question. And the usual way to think about it is to assume something like, you know, conditional independence among the neurons, which we argue here is actually the wrong approach. And there's something else that you can do, which is what we call the minimum mutual information approach, which gives you rigorous bounds on things like how well you can predict the behavior from the neuronal activity, even from very sparse measurements, and how can we quantify the information in correlation between neurons, which is also something which a lot of people are interested in these days. So this is basically the plan. So when you ask an experimentalist, a neuroscientist, what is information theory good for? So those who are actually willing to consider it favorably, which are not that many, will tell you that it's a good way to quantify correlations between stimuli and responses, which can be, you know, in the case, let's say, of the auditory system, real stimuli which we control and then measure things in the cortex and see what the activity tells us about the stimuli or vice versa. This is, you know, the classical example, of course, is what Bill and others did to the fly, or with the fly, or in the case of the motor system, which we are more interested in, you can think about responses, which is really behavior that you measure, like movement of hands, and again, how is this related to activity in the brain? So there are usually two types of signals here: stimulus, which is more or less under the experimentalist control, and we can actually design the experiment such that we know pretty well what is the distribution of the signal and have a pretty good idea about the statistical behavior of the stimuli or the behavior. Both of them can be controlled to some extent. And on the other hand, there is this neural responses, which are something which we measure, which usually live in a very high dimensional space, and we have very little idea or knowledge about the statistical behavior, although we would like to assume all sorts of things. And that's really, so why is it good? Okay, so it allows us to quantify in a model-free, model-independent way, in a sense, what is one signal telling us about another, or one set of signals telling us another. It also allows us to estimate what, through measures of, you know, synergy and redundancy, how correlation or collaboration between neurons work in the system and so on. You all know that. And of course, for an experimentalist, the main problem is this is how to estimate and therefore why should we use it at all. And those who actually try to use find it, develop all sorts of very sophisticated methods of estimation, like the direct methods and others that sometimes work very well, but they're always problematic, whatever we want to do with it. For a theorist, by mutual information, let's say, for me for that matter, is something much deeper than just, you know, a measure of correlation. First of all, it's axiomatically or mathematically can be shown to be the unique functional up to units, and I can measure it in bits or in nuts or whatever, up to essentially the base of the logarithm, that really quantifies our intuition about information in one variable about another. And there is a big confusion here, because most people who know something about information theory consider entropy, or Shannon's entropy, as the measure of information. And this is, in my view, completely wrong. I mean, entropy is not measuring information, and entropy measures maybe disorder, maybe other things. Information is always in one variable about another variable. And you always have, I mean, when you ask information, always tell me in what, about what, otherwise it didn't specify anything. So it has to be a two variable function, and it has to be in a fundamental sense invariant with respect to all sorts of manipulation of the variables. So if I let's say talk about information in a real variable about a discrete variable, any transformation of the real variable, like changing its units or even nonlinear transformation, should not affect the measure of information if it's a one-to-one transformation, let's say. Entropy is not like that. So it can be shown, it's actually not difficult to show that this is unique, that there's no other functional which really satisfy simple invariant and additivity measures that we want the information to obey. So this is, we want a mathematical and axiomatic approach. And even deeper, and I think the real reason for thinking about mutual information is really that this is what I call the generating functional, or the key theoretical entity behind the two fundamental problems of information theory. The one which is known as source coding or compression, which really governs how well we can compress information subject to some distortion constraint, which is known as rate distortion theory. As you know, mutual information is the key function there. We minimize mutual information in order to obtain good compression. And at the same time, it's the fundamental functional behind the other component, basic component of information theory. How can we transmit information through noisy channels, which is really, in that case, what we usually do, we maximize mutual information under the constraints of the channel and maybe the cost in the channel and so on. So mutual information, the same functional, when you minimize it, you get the fundamental limitations about compression. When you maximize it, you get the fundamental limitation about prediction or sending information across noisy or unreliable channels. And this is, to me, is really the real appeal. You know, just like asking a physicist, do you think about energy as a measure of something useful, or do you think about energy as Hamiltonian that generates the dynamics? And that's an entirely different way of thinking about the same function. One as a functional that actually generates something much deeper, and the other one is just a measure of something useful. But why is it useful? Because it's actually a generating function of something else. Now, it also, by the very nature of information theory, gives us model-free or model-independent ways to analyze data, which is also very, very important in my mind, especially when you talk about neuroscience, because we can of course cook up models of the brain as much as we like and play with them, but really don't know what's going on there. And we would like to have measures which are independent of our assumptions about the system. So that's again why we would like to think about information. And also, there's a whole line of work that I'm involved in and many others that extend this notion of mutual information, which is, I hope all of you know how it is defined. I don't have to write it down, but it can be extended very easily to more than two variables and actually go beyond the notion of a two-variable mutual information and actually beyond the original notion of source and channel coding. And there is a lot that can be said about it. I won't say too much about it, but there's a multivariate extension of mutual information. Yes?
It's not clear to me what the natural kind of thing seems to be. You could either go, if you have the intersection of three circles, you could either go for, you know, all the intersections.
Okay, no, I know this. I know all this. This is not the topic of this talk. Let's not just, this is a diversion. We can tell you why we think that there is really one natural extension that captures everything you want, which is really this multi-information. The others talk about some different aspects depending on what subset you want to assume independent. Actually, is related to something that I'm going to say later, but we can talk about it at some later phase maybe. This is just where I come from. So when we talk about the IT, the information theoretic way in neuroscience, Why is it useful? So again, it allows us to compare different aspects of stimuli in a given responses. Of course, all the long line of works of Bill Bialik and others, which is related to this. I mean, what is it in the stimulus that the neurons care about? And Bill developed all this method that we just heard about, a set of methods that allow us to, so again, in a model-independent way, discover what is it the system is trying to discover, what is the system encoding or breaking the code, if you want. It allows us to test temporal coding limits. So again, work that comes from Bill, but many others are doing it as aspects of the response about the given stimulus. And actually something we did, there should be another bullet there, is really compare the importance of cortical area, let's say in the auditory system. This is the work of Gatchachik and Ellie Nolkin and others, which I found actually very intriguing, trying to, again, in a model-independent way, recover, say, something which is not a fantasy, it's coming from the data, about the way different levels of the auditory system or the motor system represent behavior. And essentially, it's a very appealing measure, because all you have to do is just, you know, fix the stimuli and test for different whys. The structure of mutual information is very, very simple, so in principle. Now, when we talk about multivariate responses, that's what I want to talk about, so usually we think about either one or some combination of these two scenarios. One is that we have a neuronal ensemble, that we have many, many, many different neurons in different locations in the brain. Let's call this, so R is actually high-dimensional space. We're talking about a population of neurons. And so that's the kind of thing that we can think about, a spatial ensemble, or we can think about a temporal ensemble, which where those responses are coming from measurements at different times. Both of them immediately grow exponentially with the number of the size of your ensemble, and just writing it like this is already inaccessible in terms of estimating the marginal distribution over these responses, especially when we measure them independently, or measure them in different experiments, or measure them in a way which doesn't allow us even to estimate anything about correlation. So these are the two basic setups that I want to address here: the neuronal ensemble and the temporal response. Now, so how do we estimate mutual information? So again, so we have this external variable, which is behavior stimuli, which is usually under our control. We have the internal variable, which can be many things. High dimensional, usually we don't control it, we know very little about it. And we are trying to estimate the mutual information between the two. Estimating the mutual information between the two, in principle, of course, if we just write down the expression for mutual information, requires knowledge of the joint distribution. The joint distribution is not measurable. I mean, unfortunately, as I say. So, although some people, Ilya in particular, will tell you that there are ways of estimating mutual information without knowing the joint distribution, but then you have to be really clever. I mean, you have to use some sort of compression schemes, we have all sorts of very nice universal compression algorithms from which you can extract mutual information. But again, all of these things are asymptotic in a sense, and it's not always even easy to estimate the error. A lot of people have worked on it, and usually get an overestimation. So as I said, PSR is high dimensional and not accessible directly. So what can we do? So one thing we can do is to bound the information, to find lower bounds on the information. Lower bounds are actually very useful. If we can find measures that tell you, okay, this is the information in the system is at least this value, I will be happy. If we can find rigorous lower bounds. Of course, one way to do it. Okay, of course. The point is to get non-trivial lower bounds. Zero is a very useful lower bound, as you know. Because it tells me something. It gives me a guarantee. Let's say if Andy wants to move the arms of the robot or whatever using neurons, I would like to give him a number that says if you measure 100 neurons, then you are guaranteed to do something good. I could, and I can give such a number. So let's say for an engineer who actually want to design systems that interact with neurons, a lower bound is actually very useful. Okay, maybe you can do better. And if it's a non-trivial, of course, trivial lower bounds are trivial lower bounds. What can you do? But as you know, this business, which is very popular in computer science, of bounding things, lower bounds are usually difficult to obtain. And so one thing that we want to get here, I mean, I want a lower bound on an algorithm complexity or something like this, is always not very easy to say. Now, the data processing inequality, yes, please, interrupt me if you want. I'm surprised that you let me speak so quietly and so forth. So, you probably must be tired. But a lower bound is usually, it can be achieved on mutual information by something called the data processing inequality. Should I explain it? No, okay. So data processing inequality essentially is a Markov chain, like, tells us if we throw in my information, we throw in information, which means if we take a function of, let's say, my responses, so the information between my stimulus, any function of the response, cannot be larger than the information in the response itself. So there's always an inequality of that, whatever the function is. And if I can find useful function, that's a big if, if I have a method of actually estimating, finding useful functions of the responses, which at the same time don't lose too much information, then I'm in good shape, because then I might be able to actually estimate, get a good estimate of the joint distribution of S and FR, or maybe some other function, G of S and F and R, which will give me a lower bound. And of course, I would like to make this lower bound as tight as possible. And now, of course, this leads us to a whole line of work that I've been involved in, which I call the information bottleneck approach, which essentially design algorithms for finding good functions like this, okay? That preserve information, but that's not what I want to talk about here. Yes, please. I'm still trying to talk slowly enough. Maybe Bill will show up. I don't know.
But in figuring out what a useful function is, don't you already have? Isn't already part of the guess of what the response is doing? Aren't you already solving part?
You're absolutely right. There is some sort of a circle here, circular argument here. Finding good functions requires some knowledge about what it is that you want to know. But you can do it. That's the beauty of this approach, and you can do it in a successive way. I mean, you can refine your resolution about the data. How do I say it? Successively. I mean, so you start with a very coarse-grained picture, and then improve your resolution. And there is a nice way that this method allows you to actually refine your resolution. You start with a very coarse-grained quantized version of your spaces, and then refine it and get more and more information. And this way actually leads to some sort of relevant functions in a systematic approach, which I'm not going to talk about here. But of course, but in principle, if you could estimate the joint distribution of p of some function of the stimulus and some other function of the response, you have a lower bound on the mutual information in the system. Yes. Yes. Actually, it goes back to this old notion of sufficient statistic, if you want, which really goes back to the 20s and Fisher again. What is it? Is there a function of a sample or a function of a complex variable that captures all the information about something else? And for a very special class of distribution, which turns out to be very important, all these exponential forms, there are good functions that capture all the information. This is what statisticians usually call sufficient statistics, and they obey an equality here if we can find them. The point is that if we don't know the distribution, we don't have a way of finding sufficient statistics, and essentially all what those type of methods is about is some automatic way of learning approximate sufficient statistics. Now, if we go back to populations and neuroscience. So again, we have this high-dimensional response, let's say over n times beans. As I said, the joint distribution. I'm sorry, those slides were sent to me this week by Amir, and there are many things here which are slightly disturbing to me, but never mind. So the joint distribution PRNS is some of those slides. Not all the slides are Amir's slides, but this is one of them. So it can be estimated reliably, but what we really want to do is to estimate IR of n, and the data processing is not going to help, because in most cases, if we just guess a function, we're still estimating f of rn, unless this function is really highly compressive. It's really throwing all these exponential patterns of rn into a finite or small number of possibilities, like clustering, for example. In most cases, this is going to be exponential as well. So here we would like to propose a different approach. What is it that we really trust about the data? So what we can trust, as I already said several times, we can usually trust the stimulus distribution. As I said, I mean, in all controlled experiments, we either control the stimulus directly, like in auditory system, or in the fly experiment, which Bill and Rob controlled completely the stimulus. It was Gaussian, and exactly the kind of Gaussian that they wanted, and so on. Or in the motor system, we can control the behavior. I mean, so we do this monkey moving hands experiment, which is fully controlled. We know exactly how many directions the monkey can move. We balance the experiments such that all of them are equally probable, or things like this. So we have a full control of a P of S. We usually, and of course this is a big if, but this is the assumption of all this experiment, that we can estimate the response of one neuron conditioned on the stimulus. So out of this high-dimensional space, we usually have reasonably good estimate of those conditional marginals. So without this, we're really lost. So usually what we measure one neuron, we measure another neuron, we measure another neuron, and we collect this ensemble, and we estimate, we have those conditional responses. Sometimes we can do more than one neuron, we can do two, maybe three, but you know, it's order one compared to the large size of the network. And we can also play with the time bins. I'll tell you something about this later on. So what is this type of information telling us about the true mutual information between the ensemble, the population, and the stimulus? Yes?
What exactly do you mean by the distribution P of R, I, D, and S?
I mean just what I said. I mean you fix S, or you know S, and then you measure the activity of one neuron.
At a given, so this is the probability to see a spike from...
And the probability to see a spike, and you can smooth it at the rate. Of course, there's an issue here. What is it that you really measure? But it's usually the probability of seeing a spike or seeing a distribution of a histogram of rates as a function of time for a given neuron. This is the thing that people measure and, this, and show you in the raster plots. It's a histogram of rates. It can be, of course, depend. Of course, you may want the specific times of the spikes. It's the whole spike train. You may want to smooth it into a rate function or things like this. So again, our question is, what can we say about this, which is really what we want to know, the mutual information to the whole thing. So one fallacy, in my opinion, which is very common in this business, is to use conditional independence assumption. So you can see it. I don't want to give you the long list of people who have been using conditional independence assumption as the baseline for measurements. And so one of the key points of this talk is to tell you that conditional independence is not good. It's actually not what you should assume. And there have been recent papers and a lot of heated arguments about this particular point. And that's again one thing I wanted Bill to hear. But so usually what people assume is that okay, we have those conditional marginals, let's assume, or let's compare as a baseline, the conditional independence distribution, which is just taking the product of the marginals. It looks very nice, it looks very, very appealing. We assume that the cells are independent given the stimulus, and that's a very good baseline. So the question is, what does it actually tell us about the true distribution, the true information? So what usually people do is they try to calculate the conditional independent information, which is not that easy. And they find usually that it doesn't even give us a bound. Because, you know, this trivial redundant thing, for example, that the two responses are identical. I have two cells which respond in exactly the same way to the stimulus. Is going to give us lower information than the conditional independence. So conditional independence is already assuming a lot about the system. Actually, a conditionally independent ensemble is more informative than what we usually see in the brain. In the brain, we usually see a highly, what we call, redundant systems. There is a lot of degeneracy there. And those, so which means that the conditional independence is not even giving us a lower bound. Okay, so if people know that, so then people try to compare the conditional independence assumption to the true estimate of the information and design all these measures of synergy and redundancy. If it's higher, then they are synergistic. If it's lower, then they are redundant. But again, what I want is some sort of a rigorous bound on the true distribution, and the conditional information, conditional independence assumption is not going to give me that. No, I'm not saying that.
And this would maximize the information.
It's not maximizing information.
A long way towards creating this redundancy is to reduce information. So maybe information is not a relevant thing. Because as this observation showed, it would be much easier to increase this by just disconnecting the neuron from one.
That's right. But it's a different lack of... What I'm saying is that from the experimentalist point of view, you want to estimate information about the system that you don't see. Using the conditional estimation independence assumption is not a good way to estimate what's going on, because in most cases you're going to get lower information than that.
Yeah, that's a practical issue, but if you try to think, you know,
what's the brain is doing? Why there is redundancy? Because it's doing many other things. because it has to be robust, because there are many, many other reasons for the redundancy. But inherency in a single experiment, I mean, this is the same system is used for many different things, and you are bound, you're tunneling it, you are forcing it to work in a very constrained environment, and in that case, you're going to see, of course, a lot of redundancy, because most of the neurons are not going to do anything special. But in another setup, they're doing something else. So we are looking at the very partial biased view of the brain, but what I'm saying, this is a standard assumption, and there are really many papers that treat the condition dependence as the baseline for many things. Yes, Nick? Yeah, you're right, but maybe we can do better than that. Well, that's, yes. No, you can define redundancy. I'm sure that many of you have seen it, by essentially the difference between the true information, in this case the joint, minus the sum of the conditional independence assumption, in this case, the additive. This is one way of doing it. Actually, different papers define redundancy in different ways, but that's one very common way of doing it. And if it's positive, it's synergistic. If it's negative, it's redundant, or vice versa, depending. But that's basically what people do. So,
Marcus Meister example.
Right. Yes, you're right. I mean, so.
So if neurons are correlated, they can actually increase.
Sure. No, I'm not saying that redundancy is always increasing information. It's actually decreasing.
Sometimes it's
increasing. Okay. I'm not that familiar with what you're already talking about. Maybe you should take it offline, but I'll be happy to hear about it later. I want to get to the main point somehow, and then we can discuss it forever. So one approach, which seems to be so natural that we were very surprised that it was not taken seriously before, is to, okay, why don't we just minimize the mutual information with respect to everything that we know? So we have what we really trust is as those conditional marginals, and maybe the stimulus distribution, maybe some other things. Maybe we have some correlation measurements. Maybe we have a lot of experimental data, which obviously is insufficient, because if you could measure everything, then we knew the whole distribution. This is very much in the spirit, by the way, of the maximum entropy principle, which tells you if you have some partial observations about a distribution, you want a safe guess which doesn't assume anything else, maximize the information, and maximize the entropy. This is Jane's maximum entropy principle. It's actually, if you think about it philosophically, it's not very, very sound, because there's always an assumption there that you have an access to the microscopic states of the system and that they are uniformly distributed in some sense. On the other hand, if you think about minimizing information, you can avoid this assumption, which is actually something very nice about this principle. I'm giving you some partial observations about two variables, and what I want now is to see what is the minimum, the least information, or which is really precisely the information given by your observations. Nothing else. I don't want to assume anything else. So just minimize it. So it sounds very simple. So what we're actually saying is, okay. You're giving me measurements. You trust only what you measure.
Okay.
And I don't want to assume anything about anything else, although sometimes I can, because you know there are all sorts of symmetries in the system. There also, I know that I have a random sample, for example, which can give me a better bound. That's right. But this very simple, very naive approach, why don't we just minimize the information and see what happens? So essentially what we do here is we define the set of all distributions, all possible distributions that are consistent with my observations. In this case, consistent with the two marginals, the conditional marginals and the stimulus marginal. And then minimize the information. So we can show that this minimum information, this information in this class, this set of distributions, is a convex set of distribution. Under those type of constraints, it's convex under linear expectation constraints, for example, as you all know. It is convex under many, many types of constraints, which are usually measurable. So you know, any types of observation, types of physical observation, which gives you expectation, always assume some linearity, and therefore gives you convex constraint. So in this set, there's a unique minimum to the mutual information.
There's no assumption
smoothness, anything like this?
I'm not showing anything. Anything else?
What does P star look like?
Okay, I'll show you in a minute. So what we claim is that we have an algorithm which actually is even efficient to calculate this P star. Yes?
Sorry, another question? So of course, typically, another practical problem is you always undersample the stimulus distribution. So you can't possibly look at all possible stimuli.
Oh, sure, but that's precisely the point. I mean, I'm controlling it completely. I usually restrict it to something very small, very low dimensional, fully controlled. That's what experimentalists do.
But then how do you know that has anything to say with the actual...
Oh, yeah. That's the basic... The basic question of the experimental design. I mean, how do you design a good experiment that really tells you something?
But it's more than that, right? I mean, it's more than that because the responses you get, the usual Grumble reviewer might make if you present checkerboard stimuli would be that how do you know it's the same thing that you would get under natural scene statistics, in which case the question becomes, what exactly do you mean by natural scene? So.
No, I agree. There's no procedure, automatic procedure that I know for designing good experiments. I mean, there are several suggestions, usually based on information as well, but how to design good experiments. It's actually, again, part of the same circle. Yes?
You made a very fundamental assumption here, which is a system-stationary.
That's right.
That's actually exactly what you don't see in experiments, OK? So that's a fundamental problem if we see in real neural system to apply it.
You're right. I don't know. We should ask the experimentalists here. Usually, you're trying to repeat the same conditions and assume that the system is more or less the same. Otherwise, I really don't see a way around it. I mean, you want to estimate correlation in time, structure in time. You assume some sort of continuity. It's the same brain and the same experiment, more or less, although you measure different cells and different. Obviously, I don't know how to answer it. That's right.
It's something you can work with.
And I think the assumption here is that indeed, if you feel that class is given to you and you are going to bound it with information, with respect to this definition, this specific problem model, you've chosen in some wrong way, then obviously the results are not that meaningful. But if you have a good choice of the variable X,
Tali's already sort of addressed this. Finding out what is a good choice of S may be itself an intrinsically hard problem. But I guess we should move along.
I'm not going to say too much about this.
Right.
It's a very good question.
So
I'm sure the experimentalists deal with it every day, but. You know, so we are trying to find the right stimulus that create the most interesting response, and then we design an experiment. Well, I don't know if any...
No, but the point is that finding a good definition of S has nothing to... I don't think it has something in particular to do with estimating information. You need to solve this problem anyhow, even if you want to estimate a standard correlation.
Okay, I have a very simple point to make here, and then we can argue forever. It's really simple. I mean, usually I compress too much into my talks. This one, I hope, is simple enough. So, yes?
Quick question to make sure I understand. If you take the uncorrelated distribution that you had a couple of slides back, then it would sit on a maximum of
this
the
one.
Term?
No, it's not on a maximum. It's somewhere in between.
But I thought you had this inequality. So.
No. What do you mean? Which inequality? The conditional independence doesn't give you either a maximum or a minimum. You can't say too much about it. It's in between. And that's one of the points I want to make, because people are using conditional independence all the time.
Be on this curve?
The conditional independence?
Yes.
Somewhere. I don't know. It can be here.
Nowhere special.
Yeah.
On the one...
Well, it depends, of course. Unless your true distribution is conditional independent. Then it will be the minimum. Yeah.
But if it's not, then by adding...
No, it must be...
Either increase or decrease.
No. But let me just make the... Use this curve. So first of all, I define this class of all distributions. And then I claim that this P1, which is all the distribution consistent with first order marginals in this case, then we are going to move to PK and so on. So there is one distribution which is actually far from the reality. I don't claim anything about this P star, the one with minimized information about the true data. It only gives me a useful bound. That's what I want. The true distribution is somewhere. Where is it? Depends on the true system. I mean, it's higher than the minimum, unless the system is really very... Actually, there are very interesting properties to this minimum information distribution, which I want to discuss in a second, but obviously we don't claim that it's a realistic model of the system, and that's why most people tend to avoid this type of thing. It's a mathematical construction that I make in order to get good estimates. Now, so the question is whether we can find this P of star. And of course, once I have the true minimum, then I can find useful bounds. Because so the true information is always is lower bounded by the minimum. This is a trivial statement. But it's some sort of a data processing like inequality without the search of the useful function. So if I can do this in some sort of in a model independent way, I actually find a useful bound. And it reflects, in some sense, the notion of a worst case analysis of the data. And this actually is an interesting notion. We can show that we can think about it in some sort of a game theoretic way. We are playing the devil's advocate against the experimentalist and trying to say, okay, the brain is the worst that you can possibly know under what you are allowed to measure. What can you say then? Okay. And so this is a very simple notion, and the similar, as I said, can be extended to higher order correlation, and we are going to play with this in order to define the information in correlation. This is related again to some people here in many ways. Yes.
So maybe that's what you're going to talk about, but you have some functions for how close some distance metric between the estimated minimum probability and the true probability is a function of some measurement.
Yes. I'm going to show. I hope something like this. I hope I understand your question. So once we have this, yes, sure. I cannot see you. But yes. It's precisely this the same idea. But he's talking about maximum entropy, and I'm talking about minimum information. I think it's actually even nicer there. Now, so once we have this, we can do all sorts of things, estimate information in population, at least find, and see how much we actually gain by using a pairwise or single cell, so information in dynamic processes of the respondents, in the importance of the binning, how much different bins gives us in terms of actually, and there are many other things that we can do once we have a rigorous bound. That's something which is not sufficiently always, not estimated sufficiently by physicists, I think. But we are, of course, losing something. And we'll tell you later. Of course, we don't know. The bound is uncontrolled in a sense. I mean, we can be a lot better than what the bound gives us. But the question is whether the bound is useful. So this is again Michel's question. So how do we calculate it? So here is a little bit about the algorithm. So essentially, what we have here is a constraint optimization problem. You want to minimize the convex functional subject to a set of constraints, and as I said, those constraints are just the marginal distribution that we know. Or if you maybe we know much less, we know some expectation values, we know some correlation function, we know things which you usually measure in experiments. They all usually fit into this convex optimization problem. And so the nice thing about the function of mutual information is that you can easily minimize it analytically. And what you find is that there are two functions that comes, so the shape, the form, the functional form of the minimum is, again, here I'm actually using information as a generating function, is exponential. It's always of an exponential form. Actually, this goes down to something more fundamental. Where is the... Oh, God, I skipped one slide here. It's actually, I find very important. Let me... Bear with me for a second. I just want to... This one is hidden, and I don't want it to be hidden. Okay. So there's a since this is after all a theoretical physics place, let me give you a little bit of a theoretical insight. So there's a notion which I find very useful, but most people think is completely useless, of projections which minimize cross KL divergences. Should I explain what KL divergence is? I don't know. It depends on. So KL divergence is essentially the measure of some sort of a measure of similarity or distance between two distributions, which is really the key functional behind many other functions in information theory. In particular, mutual information is the KL divergence between the joint distribution and the product of the two marginals. Okay, so it's a positive, non-negative entity, which is zero exactly if the two distributions are equal. And one nice thing about it is that you can define a distance between some distribution, let's say in this case Q, some given distribution, and the class of other distributions. The distance between any two of them is defined for this KL, and you can project or find the closest point in your set to the external distribution, to the data. Now, there are essentially two types of projections. The KL divergence is a not symmetric measure. One of the distributions, the one on the left, appears with a p log p. So it's always a product of the distribution by the logarithm of the distribution. And the other one appears without only the logarithm, in the denominator in the logarithm. So there's a big difference between projecting, minimizing the distribution with respect to the first argument, the less argument, and minimizing the KL divergence with respect to the second argument. When we minimize with respect to the first argument, we always get exponential forms. This is with linear constraints. I mean, we get, because the p log p, when you take the derivative, you get the log, and then this puts you immediately in the exponent, the rest of it. This is what gives you the exponential forms of the maximum entropy distributions, and also here. Here we get a marginal, another unknown distribution, which is the denominator in the case of the KL or mutual information. And this is called by some people like Cesar and then Amari and others, I projection. It turns out actually the other projection, minimizing with respect to the Q, is also very interesting. It usually gives us some trivial identities in terms of the marginalization of the distributions, which are usually linear and actually very useful in formal proofs of all sorts of things. And so what we do here is essentially an I projection of our experimental, of our desired distribution in the set. We minimize a function, which is really finding an I projection in the class of functions that satisfy our constraints. So,
question?
Yes.
So if
I'm sorry, I have to go backward. Yes, so.
Question?
Yes.
So
Well, it depends on your data. If they're uncorrelated, then you'll get the mutual information zero. That's right. This is the minimum information distribution. So minimizing the mutual information subject to no constraints is going to give you zero information and independence. But you have constraints which force dependence. That's the point. You have correlations, let's say, that change from one stimulus to another. And that's precisely going to generate information. Yes. No. This is a rigorous statement here. I mean, convexity is true under this type of constraint. Where was I? Yeah. So I defined this class of functions, P1. This type of constraints and many others, like expectation values of anything, are always generating linear convex sets. So, which means that if there are two functions here that satisfy them, then any convex combination of them will also satisfy the same constraints. So, this is a convex set of distributions. And now, the mutual information, as a special case of a KL divergence, is a convex function over these variables, and therefore it has a unique minimum there. Which is actually nice to know. As you probably know already, I mean, what makes optimization problems easy or hard is not whether there are linear or nonlinear, as some people used to think, but whether they are convex or non-convex. And convex optimization is a much easier and much better defined optimization problem. So this is a convex optimization problem. It doesn't mean that it's really necessarily easy, but necessarily easy to do. But what we get, as I said, the formal solution is this type of solution, the exponential form, which has a product of an exponent of some functions, which depends on my observations that are essentially Lagrange multipliers to the constraints that I have in the data, and I get also another unknown function, which is the marginal, which is not the marginal. Actually, this is a constructive, some sort of construction that through the proof, which are called p star of Rn. This is the minimum information marginal on my space. And this turns out to be a very interesting entity. And of course, there's also a normalization which I have to worry about when I do these things. No, so as I said, psi are going to be Lagrange multipliers which are associated with the constraints, which what I know. So there are there's each constraint for each marginal that I measure. That's in a single cell.
And the constraints, once again, that they are A, that the distribution stimuli is what you presented, and B, that the distribution of responses.
The single cell responses are what is what I know. These are the constraints. So I do it for every possible value of R, but it's a single R, not all of them. That's why it's not exponential anymore. And we have a way of actually calculating this psi. And of course, Z is just a normalization function. Now, first of all, usually you don't record them at the same time. And my assumption is that I have this type of... I'm sorry, there's some sort of delay between... These are the constraints. It's essentially independent for each cell.
So once again, this is the observation you
This made. Is observation I make. That's right. If you have pairwise observation, please tell me. Okay. There's a lot of information there.
So
okay.
No, it's not in P1.
Pairwise, it's P2 already.
It's in P1.
Yeah.
So the P1,
to illustrate the idea, P1 is what we usually measure. It's the single conditional distribution, the single cell conditional distribution. Okay, so this is, I'm sure you can all do this exercise. If you just minimize it formally, you get Lagrange multipliers and the exponent, and you get this marginal. This comes from the fact that the mutual information is the ratio between these two. And then when you take the log, of the ratio, you get this as a product here. This should remind many of you the basic problem of the ray distortion theory, for example, where you have, again, minimizing information subject to some constraint, which is usually some sort of a distortion constraint. And you don't know what is this distribution over the input to the channel. So there are two distributions you have to find, a conditional and a marginal. This marginal is unknown. And once we saw this, we said, OK, we have an algorithm for doing this. This is precisely the same algorithm that minimized information in the ray distortion problem. I think I may lose some of you here. But we know that this has to be satisfied. I mean, so this marginal must be consistent with my joint distribution through the stimulus distribution, which I know. OK, so these two equations have to be solved together, self-consistently. Is this clear? Now, the point is that this is still a convex optimization problem, and I can solve it. I mean, so you get some guess for the psi's, you calculate the marginal on R, you plug it in, you get another, you estimate again, satisfy the constraints again with the conditional, and do it until convergence. Yes. Yeah. No, it's not overcomplete.
I don't see it as the algebraic system. Is it algebraic system of equations?
Well, it's a nonlinear set of algebraic system of equations.
So how many unknowns?
So I have an equation essentially for every constraint. It's very much like usual constraint optimization. Every constraint, including the normalization, is giving me a constraint on the distribution.
Okay.
And each one of those constraints is going to give me a Lagrange multiplier, okay?
So what are the unknowns?
So the unknowns are those two distributions, the star distributions. Yeah, sure, but the point is that I don't have to measure it. I get an analytic form for this. I know that it's absolutely true. This by itself, it only looks simpler. But the arguments here... No, the equations are complete mathematically. There is exactly the same number of equations and number of constraints.
Okay, it's number of equations.
No, and my variables are over the full R to the n space. So this is a very large space.
So it's not complete.
It's exactly what happens in the maximum entropy formulation. Let's say that I have a real variable,
linear constraint. And you know, there's some optimization problem there that's given, and there's an algorithm that, and it's a convex function.
But now you can forget about it. You have these equations you want to solve, right?
Look, imagine that I'm giving you this famous moment problem, sorry.
This is an equation,
You want neutral.
Am I supposed now to solve this equation?
You need to
No, I don't care about how.
You're supposed to solve this equation. That's right.
I don't have now to remember anything.
No.
I just have to look at this equation.
There are hidden things here. I mean, those psi's depend on your constraints. So you fix the psi's are also variables in a sense. You fix them by forcing your constraint. And this is unfortunately a nonlinear problem. So you have to do. Your true unknowns are only these psi's, and of course the fact that these two things must be self-consistent with each other. These two equations. That's right. This is messy. Yeah. They're the right number. It's precisely the right number, but it's a very messy.
It's a complete system.
It's a complete system of the question. Look, you probably saw this. Let's say if I want to maximize entropy, px, ln px, this continuous variable entropy, subject to these two constraints in a real on a real variable. So there are infinitely many x's. And of course, what I also know is that the distribution is normalized. So the expectation value of 1 is 1. And if I have three constraints, I have three Lagrange multipliers. And I know that my distribution must be of this form, something like 1 over z, e to the minus lambda 1 x minus lambda 2 x squared. OK?
OK, so you reduce it to three equations.
Yes. And those lambdas are precisely those psi's. I just write it instead of a product. It's actually a product of some function of r and some function of s. I wrote it the function of the two variables. But that's what it is. OK?
Another question?
Yes.
So if I have some observation which has to show some correlations between the stimulus and response, it's very naive. So it is still likely that I just got those correlations by accident, right? So it's still possible.
Yes.
The underlying mechanism could be uncorrelated.
You're absolutely right. There is experimental error, which means that. Okay, which means that you are within the error bars or something.
If you measurements.
Yes.
So for each experimental measurement,
you're absolutely. You're talking about something very fundamental. I have to estimate the reliability of my minimum estimation, which depends, of course, on the stability of this algorithm with respect to errors in my data.
Right.
We can do this analysis. This is actually simple. It's even actually related to something that you said yesterday. I mean, it's some sort of a stability analysis. And you can, it depends on things like the Fisher information of this minimum information distribution, and I know how to calculate it. That's nice when I think about it. It's an exponential form. You can easily calculate the stability metrics and see how sensitive your estimation is to the errors in your measurements. This is actually something.
I just can't say it I think it's clear that for any measurement, for any experimental measurement, the minimum of mutual information is zero.
For any measurement?
For any measurement. Because it's
A random measurement, yeah. A random measurement in some sense, not any measurement.
For every complete measurement.
Will give you very little information. So I don't know. There's a subtle issue here. As you probably know, there's a bias, a positive bias of the mutual information from small samples. So for example, the thing that Travis and Pazieri estimated. So if you have a small sample, even a random sample will give you some positive information because there's a bias. So a random distribution, a random sample of independent things is still informative because it's really unlikely to get exactly a product of the marginals in a random sample. So there's a bias, and you have to correct for this bias. But that's something else. Okay. Let me. It's not independent of what I'm saying, but it's a different issue. So again, so how do we do it? So there's an algorithm which we call min MI or min mi, And it's actually, there was a nice paper at UAI just 2 months ago, even less than that, beginning of July, which presented all the theory behind this algorithm. There's some nice things to know about it. So first of all, solving this equation is not as simple as it looks, because essentially it requires, for example, calculating this marginal requires going over all through. Remember, we don't have a nice functional form like this. We actually have to go through all the x's and specify numerically a value, but that's a mess. I mean, we're talking about an exponential space, so what's the big gain? So it seems that we are trapped again in this case of dimensionality. We didn't really avoid the real problem as if we solve it numerically. Just, you know, going through all the possible values of the R to the N possibilities is not something we want to do. And it seems unnecessary because we're not really using it in any place. Our constraints are much, much on a much lower dimensional. So we have to go. So what we actually do is we perform the I projection, this convex optimization, or actually using a variant of an algorithm called generalized iterative scaling, or GIS, which is some sort of a standard technique for doing maximum entropy, essentially. But notice that unlike maximum entropy, and this is really unlike, let's say, the work that Elad Shneiman and Bill and others have published recently. There was a PRL just a year ago or something. We're not maximizing entropy, we're minimizing information, and there's a big difference because we don't know the two marginals. Now, so what's going to happen is these two iterations are going to, so we do GIS, and then we project on the, we calculate the marginal PT of Rn, and this turn out to and reduce the information again using this marginalization equation. But notice that this equation is actually a mess, because we have to, every iteration we get an exponential form here, this is simple, the GIS, but then we plug it here again and we get a mixture, because this stimulus has several values. Summing over the stimulus give us numerically, it's not a sum over the side of the stimulus term, and exponential of this at every iteration. So this very naive, straightforward equation, iterate those, is actually causing an exponential sum, exponential in the stimulus size. So even the stimulus is only binary, it's already 2 to the k, where k is the number of iterations. And this is something we really wanted to avoid. So just solving it directly in terms of what we know about convex optimization, although in principle is solvable, is giving us a real headache in terms of the size of this distribution. So we looked for other techniques for doing it. As I said, this is all related to. So first of all, in principle, what you do is really this. I mean, you iterate these two things, you force the constraints, the marginal constraint, calculate the sum of them, and get your new marginal, then plug it in, and repeat these things until convergence. But as I said, every iteration you get more and more terms in your prior. So one thing we noticed is that those prior distributions, this marginal, tend to center on very, very few points in space. That's something I can give a whole talk about it, but there's something very intriguing here. It tends to find something which are very analogous to support vectors in support vector machine. So it turns out that the constraints are really inducing a small, very small dimensional critical values of your space on which everything else depends. So you can really forget about everything else except the values of this margin on a finite set of points, in most cases, and this finite set of points is exactly the size of your constraints. So everything, it turns out that we don't really need to calculate everything, because there's only a finite support to this distribution. This is an observation that I find intriguing, because it gives you the notion of a margin and support in a fully statistical sense, which has nothing to do with geometry.
Is this an empirical observation?
No, there's a proof. There's a rigorous statement. Yes, there's a proof that this is going to converge when the minimum information is going to be in the corner of some simplex. So which means that it's going to in terms of the margin itself.
In the general case, you conclude that you need to consider only a small subset.
A small subset, that's right.
Do you have any...
Unless
out of this group, you have any estimate of the number of parameters?
No, so the number is really the order of the number of constraints, exactly the number of your constraints. So actually, the space is a lot smaller than what you really need to know. Yes? That's right. That's right. Okay, thank you for the question. So, again, it emphasizes again that what we estimate has nothing to do with the real system. It's a mathematical construction that identifies the critical points in your data with respect to your given constraints. If you change the constraint, the points are going to move. It's very much like the support vectors in support vector machine. You have data, and then it turns out that everything depends only on the thing that happens on the margin, exactly on these very few points. Everything else is irrelevant, is determined by it. It turns out that those constraints select a certain point in space which are going to affect mostly your observations, and if you change those, you change everything. I don't want to say that the system actually cares about those specific points very much. It's just the observation are very sensitive to this. No, they are. That's essentially a compression of your data into very few points, which tells you everything that you need to know in order to classify a new point.
Does that mean that, when, in particular, to follow up on Ilya's question, when you want to converge the optimum,
yes,
does that still have marginals that are supported at a discrete set of points?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Only the optimum. The minimum actually, you can get very close to it with a much wider margin. And that's what we do in practice.
But then, in effect, what's happening, if I've understood correctly what Ilya's comment was and what your response was, is that, indeed, at the end of the day, you're selecting a distribution that basically says what you saw happen, nothing else happened. And indeed, it's reasonable to think that that would have the minimum amount of information. I mean, a flatter distribution would have more. But then I would echo Ilya's question. Why is that a good thing? As in, why is that a good lower bound? All we want is the lower bound, right? That's right. But, so why is that a good lower bound? Why should that not be very far from the reality if the real distribution was supposed to be much smoother?
So again, I understand the question. I think it's important to realize that what I want is a rigorous lower bound, first of all. And then I'll try to convince you that the lower bound is useful. Where is it? It also identifies something interesting, which is, in my view, analogous to the notion of a support vector. Now, if you think about support vector machines, I hope that all of you know something about it. And what they eventually do is find the maximum margin classifier, and this margin lies on very few points in your data. Maybe a picture here is useful. So if you have a set of points, let's say pluses and minuses, I don't know. So the maximum margin is going to be something like this. In this case, I don't know. Well, I'm probably, let's say, I put another point here. And so this is the maximum margin, where the margin is the distance between the pluses and the minuses, in this case, the maximum that I can achieve, and it's going to rely on very few points. So everything outside of this margin is determined already. I really don't need to give you the label here, because if I know the labels of these points, everything else is determined. What I'm saying is that there is an analogous notion to support vector. This is a geometric notion. Okay, there's an analogous notion in statistical data, which has to do with the support of this minimum information margin. What does it mean? It means that your data is extremely sensitive. Your measurements are extremely sensitive to what happens in very few points in your data set. It's actually good to know that for an experimentalist, that everything else is determined by what happens in maybe a very few bins or very few cells, and the rest are determined by it. It's not really important. So your results are affected, your minimum information results are affected by very few points. I'm not saying that this is what it has anything to do with the true activity of the system. So this is a slightly confusing, I think, subtle point.
Even if the bound is not part, you can learn things out of it. So let's say you have a neural model which is interacting with a set of other neurons. Okay? And now you do this analysis, and you have the hypothesis that this one will be doing a binary decision. Okay? And now you do this analysis, and you obtain an overall estimate of 2 days. Okay? So you have a physical meaning, right? So you can know the thing of these neurons is making a binary decision, because it obtains 2 bits of information.
I'm going to say exactly this point in the next slide.
This is in contrast to a standard correlation, right? Because if you measure correlation, it has no units. Right? But information has meaningful units.
I'm already way beyond the time that I was supposed to talk. Let me try to get further. And I knew that it's going to be difficult to get even this talk through here, but it's all right. So there is another technical issue, which maybe I should skip, is that we can solve the whole problem using a dual formulation of the convex optimization problem. Again, for those of you who follow the machine learning literature, you know that there's a whole excitement now about convex optimization and in its dual space. And so you can actually show that since this is a convex problem, you can solve it in an entirely different formulation, which is maximizing this functional. This is very much, you know, like moving from entropy to free energy or something, minimum energy to free energy in statistical mechanics. Minimizing this functional with respect to the psi's under these constraints. And it turns out that this is much simpler to do because you avoid this exponential sum over the marginal that I had before. Maybe I shouldn't elaborate here. So the algorithms for doing this, standard convex optimization problem algorithm like interior problem, ellipsoid, and you can also do it if the space is really large using Monte Carlo or using Gibbs sampling in order to verify that you don't have points that contradict, violate your constraints. This is a computer science issue, forget about it. So here's just a very simple example how it works. Imagine that I have two binary neurons. And the binary stimulus, the simplest possible thing that I can have in mind, two neurons that are either firing or not firing, and the stimulus which is either 0 or 1. And let's say that I have those observations, four numbers. The probability of seeing 1 in R1 given the stimulus 1 is 0, it's 0.4, and so on. In this case, I have altogether 8. Eight variables, which is 2 by 2 by 2, and four constraints given by this, and an additional two normalization constraints. So I have 6 constraints altogether. The problem is almost overdetermined, but there are only two parameters here that I have to estimate, so I can actually plot this in two dimensions and show you the full optimization. And what you see here in this color diagram is precisely how this mutual information looks like. And the minimum point is precisely here. And you start anywhere, and you get there very quickly in any optimization problem. So this is just, in principle, what we do. We take out of the 8 constraints, 6 constraints, 8 unknown. Of course, in general, it's a lot worse than that. And there's a very simple optimization, convex optimization problem. Now, what you see here actually turns out to be very general. The minimum is very wide, very robust. So that's why I really don't have to push this all the way. I get very little improvement in my information if I converge to here and here. This is a very, very nice wide minimum. Now, which actually has to do with the stability analysis I mentioned. Fisher information is large. Yeah, so it's exponential with four numbers, and those sides have four values, and there's nothing very interesting about it. The exponent is four terms, and the space is a binary space. So this has four entries here. Well, I don't care too much about that. That's an artificial example, but. You see that the minimum information is not zero. It's something, I don't know, I don't have the scale here. But it doesn't really matter, I just want to show the principle. So one useful thing that we get out of it, this is again a point that we made in this UAI paper, is that we can now give a bound, a rigorous bound on the prediction error of our algorithm. So essentially, I can tell you how much I can get close to the optimal Bayes classification error if I'm trying, let's say, to predict the stimulus from the response. So I'm trying to play the mind-reading game, which you play all the time, I guess, that I want to guess what the monkey is going to do by looking at his neural activity. So essentially, this is a standard classification or prediction problem. I have data, and I want to predict S. Now, there is a classical bound, which I don't want to prove, that tells you that the Bayes error is bounded by above by half the conditional entropy. This is something that goes to the 70s or 60s in information theory. It's really a relatively simple bound. This is the one that Raviv, Joe Raviv and others found. I think you know this bound. So Y here is the S, the thing that...
Why is
S? I'm sorry. This is one of Amir's typos. H of S minus ISR is just the conditional entropy. But this is something we know. That's the point. So this is the probability of error. If you are given a if this is a binary, if you take the log, the binary logarithm, this actually gives you the probability of error, of the Bayesian error. This is error in the Bayesian sense, probability of making a mistake. The area under the curve of the two distribution when they're both normalized. So this is a well-known bound, and we can use it to obtain a bound, a rigorous bound, on how well I can read the mind of the monkey from looking at single cells, from just the first order statistics.
Is that two cells? One cell?
Now, unless I have many cells, yeah. But I'm measuring only the first order response. I measure only the P of R given S for each cell independently. So I'm now looking at single cell ensemble, and I want to do a readout. I want to predict the behavior. So this bound tells me, okay, there's a lower bound on the error, which is maybe greater than the error, it's usually greater than, if you put here the minimum information, zero statement, I replace this information with something which is smaller than this information, so I get a bound, because it's a minimum. So the minimum actually gives me a bound, unlike, let's say, the conditional independence assumption, which doesn't give me anything. I don't know anything just by looking at the conditional independence. But this gives me a real bound on the probability of good readout, and we found it important because it turns out that these numbers are not, a bound can be, you know, if I tell you the probability is less than one, it's not a very useful thing, or less than two sometimes. But in this case, it turns out that if the entropy of the stimulus, this H of S, which is written here as H of Y, is actually small, let's say two, and the information is actually getting close to the entropy, I get actually a useful bound here. And that's actually what happens in the motor experiment that I'm going to discuss next. And I just want one slide on this game theoretic interpretation. I can think about the whole thing, the whole minimum information process, as an devil advocate game. I'm playing against the worst case scenario, and very much in the spirit of this paper of Greenwald that you mentioned. I can think about it as minimizing the error, which is the worst case, and then maximize the loss. So it's really a min-max game, which is precisely the type of analysis that I find actually is a very good general, at least for mathematicians, justifying maximum entropy or minimum information. This actually plays a very nice game. I mean, showing them that really this is the worst case analysis, or minimize the worst case error. So I just want to finish with this point. Imagine of this k-order correlation. So as I said, there was a big debate in the literature about how to estimate correlation in information in k neurons activity. Meissner and other said, I mean, I was actually directly referring to this paper of Schneidman and Beal and Berry, which all the heated argument with Peter Latham that they had about how to do it, how to estimate correlation. And what they use is slightly it's a very similar idea, but the maximum is entropy. What we are looking at is this. Now we can define the IK as the minimum information given subject to knowledge of k's order correlation. And we can define now the difference between the minimum information that you get in the k-th order minus the k minus 1, and what we call here gk, which is really how much you really gained, improved your bound by moving from k to k plus 1 order, or k minus 1 to k. This is clearly positive because adding more correlation just subsumes the other one. And it's also nice that this is just a telescopic sum, of course. So the true information is just the sum of all of them over all orders, which is a nice thing to have. And so you have a sum of positive terms. Each one of them is defined by a difference of two minimum information, which we can calculate. And we would like to call this the contribution of the kth order correlation. I think this is
you're saying that if you add more constraints, I get larger bound.
I get better bound.
Better bound.
Tighter bound.
More since it's from the
lower. Yeah, you're right. I get the minimum information is going to be higher because I add more information.
But how do you detect the problem?
Intersection of what?
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. So you get higher value. So I think that these two observations are actually very simple. That you get positive sum of positive terms. Each one of them is added by adding the next order correlation. Suggest this as a very nice way of thinking about the contribution of the case order correlation. Remember again, what is the whole idea of minimum information? I take the least committed distribution, or the one which really. This is a way of defining the information in those observations. Nothing else is there, because if there was anything else, I minimize it. I throw away everything else. So this is precisely, in my view at least, what added by looking at higher order correlation. And now you can actually do a measurement and see how much you really gain by looking at pairs or looking at triples of neurons. And again, as I said before, we're actually taking the decoder's view, really, and this view. I mean, we really try to see how much we can read. How much effort should you invest in measuring the correlation of pairs or triples of neurons in order to improve your prediction of the activity? And you can explicitly estimate it just by looking at the sum. And what I just want to show you what happens in this particular experiment to show you that you actually look at data. So this is this famous standard motor center out task where the monkey has to move in this case in 8 directions based on he has a light at the right one place, then he had to hold on and stay there until it gets a go signal, and then has to move. So essentially two periods, one which you call the hold period and the other one which you call the movement period. The monkey sits still preparing his motion, and actually it's interesting to see how much the activity of his neuron tells us about where he wants to move, and then during the movement itself. And what we did here, what Amir and Ron actually did, compared the bounds that you get on the information with the two standard things. One is the conditional independence assumption, which is the blue line, and the other one is the minimum information, minimum assumption. And you see, of course, that you get a much, much lower information. So the conditional independence really gives you an over-optimistic view of what the information in the activity is. And you see that there's slightly, maybe, I don't know if it's even significant, slightly less information about the motion in the hold period, which you see also in the condition dependence assumption. But the nice thing is that you actually still get information. They both saturate, by the way, to the value 2, which is the ultimate. I mean, that's what you can get here. It's a binary. There are 4 directions, so it's four equally probably directions. There are 2 bits of information. And so I can essentially read all the information. But this gives me a real bound on what the system performs. The blue line doesn't give me anything, as I said. And I see that this real bound is actually not so bad. I mean, with 80 neurons, I get very, very close to all the information without looking at pairs at all. So the error bars are generated by taking subsets, random subsets, and calculate the spread of this estimation. This is a standard technique of shuffling if you want to best.
So shuffle,
yeah, just to get error bars.
If the measurement is accurate, then this blue line sort of.
The blue? If no, the blue is not an upper bound. I wish I could have an upper bound. The blue is just the blue is what people look at, and what we claim here that this is not the right thing to look at. I mean, look at the green one. This gives you a true bound. It may be that the true is better, but at least here you are guaranteed that with 80 neurons you get 99% of the entropy.
People who look at the blue, they claim it's a
low bound,
or they claim.
No, they just show it as some sort of. I don't know.
No,
they claim, I don't know, they may argue about redundancy and synergy, or they may say all sorts of things about it, but it's not, in my opinion, it's not a very useful notion. It's not model free. Yeah.
I guess I'm a little confused. Is this the difference? If you're trying to make a joint probability distribution, and you take the idea that the probabilities each element are independent, so you multiply them together, versus coming up with a more complex model,
So this very easy to write distribution, the product distribution, actually not so easy to estimate the information there. It's much more complex. Whereas in our case, where it's very hard to write a distribution, it's very easy to estimate the information because it's just a linear sum because of this exponential form, and you get that this information that we estimate is a true. Well, as I said, this is precisely the answer to Misha's initial question, you see that this bound already guarantees some performance with some number of cells, and I don't know, I'm probably not answering the question. I'm not sure I got it right, but I have two more slides, and we can just finish the talk and have an informal discussion. So in this case, I actually get it for a good reconstruction. The mean me bound gives you tens of neurons, which is actually good to know, and it's much more than the condition dependent assumption. I already said that. I believe it does, but we haven't done it. I mean, this is something. It's actually very close to the condition independence assumption, I guess, the population vector. If you assume that the tuning, that's what it is, I guess, and that's maybe one of the reasons why we have to look at it. Yes, this one.
So I assume that you take the sum theory, 500
milliseconds
or so.
Yeah, and this is precisely this issue of the temporal. Well, let me talk about this.
I just wanted to know how much is 2 bits. It depends on time. I mean, if it's 2 bits per second, then it's not very much.
Okay, so you're asking me about details of the experiment.
I just want to know what the time frames.
What are the time frames?
Yes. So a whole period is usually something like 100 milliseconds, and a nuclear period is something like 200 milliseconds. So you integrate over that period of time.
Yes, I guess this is just as good answer that I can. Yes, it's actually very low information. When you think about it this way, in terms of bits per spike, there's not much there. But
not much.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a four directions, and it's 2 bits.
Yeah.
That's right. And in this case, okay, well, you know, but I'm thinking really about it, the engineering problem. I want to implant an array of neurons. What should I invest there? Do I gain anything by looking at much more complicated measurements? And the question is not necessarily. Now, or is it better to measure pairs rather than to look at more single cells and so on? So another issue is, of course, this temporal response. I mean, so most people do some sort of an integration over one long bin of the rate there versus binning it into time. The question is, what do you gain by binning in time? So Amir and Ronnie again did some very interesting set of experiments with their data. So essentially, they bin it into bins which are integer multiples of what I call the bin size, the minimum bin size, and look at the information that they get in this ensemble of rates, and see if you can actually gain more in using this minimum information algorithm. So what they calculate is precisely the minimum information distribution between this Rn, where Rn in this case is the temporal information with respect to the stimulus, and see how much information do I get from the temporal structure. This is actually an ongoing project that we also do in the basal ganglia now, and discover some very interesting things about the use of time there. But this is something else. So there's a trade-off, of course. Very, very low bin size gives you a very detailed dynamics, but very poor estimation of rate. And so this is always the case. So of course, you would like to get somewhere in between. And what they did here is essentially search over all the partitions in time with certain bin size and got very nice optimum. So this is essentially the data. What you have here is actually a laterality, the left and right motion, and they wanted to, I think it's not right hand and left hand, it's moving left or moving right, and sorry about that, but so the red and the green are the two different responses in this case for this binary decision, move left or right. And you obviously see that there is information, but the question is how much information is there if I bin it in time. And it turns out that by using this minimum information algorithm, they could find that the optimal partitioning of this data is into these four bins only. More than that doesn't give you too much. And this was better than just accumulating everything in between. And so there is a search procedure which is actually very simple that optimizes the bins. And the binning of the data, you can see the details here. So it gives you how much this minimum information change when you decrease the bin size. And you see that it saturates at some point. So this minimum bin size, which is something, let's say, 150 milliseconds, is giving you enough, much more than what you could get by looking at the full window of 750 milliseconds, so about 30% more information. So it's again, an engineering issue. How should I interpret the reading? And it's a way of actually finding the best binning. Okay, so essentially, I'm trying to present a new approach to estimate information in population when you have very partial data. And the idea is very simple: minimize the mutual information over the thing that you know. I can just give you a theoretical view here. I mean, this actually answers Another fundamental question that we always approach when we deal with methods that are based on the knowledge of the joint distribution, for example, the information bottleneck. So everybody tells me, if you know the joint distribution, why do you have to do anything? The point is that even if you don't know the joint distribution, if you know some partial observations, you can always plug in this minimum information distribution and get also of interesting. So it's not really true that you always need to estimate the mutual information, and that's why, because you can't do it, don't use mutual information. There is a way around it, which is, give me what you know, and I'll give you a good, safe guess, which is the distribution with the minimum information. And there's an algorithm for doing it. We can apply it to temporal and to population coding, and find all sorts of things which are not entirely trivial. And this last point, I'm not sure I understand, so I'll keep it there. Thank you.
Which bin you get more information, right? Which bin you get less information.
That's right.
In this regard, it's very useful to me. And when you get to the using the information measure for calculating how many neurons I need to the minimum, the lower bound, using lower bound to say how many minimum number of neurons I need to perform a task. In that case, I don't know how tight the bound is. And also the other question is this: what other frequency? I don't know if your Lagrangians are free parameters of your tightness of your bound and other parameters.
The parameters are exactly what I told you. I mean, those Lagrange multipliers, mm-hmm. and the normalization, and that's it. I mean, those this, and of course, if your observations are more complex, mm-hmm. I can try to fit it into this framework by making the convex set of distribution in which I search a little more complicated. So it's a question of how complicated your measurements are. But again, I mean, from an engineering point of view, there are always trade-offs. And so you have to ask yourself whether you should invest in more sophisticated measurements, if you can, or more cells, or I don't know what.
I see your point.
And so.
Right. I like it because I can see your point where you get pretty tight in terms of if you can specify a slide factor, right, in that sense.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yes, Michelle. And you say that you have this low bound of information, which gives you the higher bound of the number of mistakes you do when you measure some stuff. That's a useful thing, but could it be that if you would try to give this higher bound of the number of mistakes directly, you could come up with a better. Do something similar that you do. What is the maximum number of mistakes I do subject to the constraints of the measurement that I do? And if I don't, I'm not interested in the measurement. Could it be that you would
minimize the error directly?
Right. Could it be that you would, because you have an extra links there, right? All these bounds, they may help you come.
If I could do that. So this is a classical question in Bayesian. If I could minimize the error directly, why not do that? The only problem is that show me a model-independent approach to estimate the error directly, I'll be very happy.
And so it's the same thing. You are trying to find the distribution which is worse in the sense that it will provide you the minimum mutual convention. I say the same thing. Try to find the distribution which is worse in the sense that it gives you maximum mistake.
The function of your considering is no longer, it's probably no longer convex.
I don't even know how to write it. I mean, okay, I know how to write the Bayesian error if I have the two distributions, correct one. Then, okay, fine. But then, in order to optimize over all possible distribution in this case, you need some access to the things which are not accessible to me. The point is here that I by thinking about the minimum information, I get a functional form which is manageable. This notion of minimizing the error directly has been around for a long time, and it's never really in the model context. If you have a parametric model, then you can do that in some cases.
So did you compare?
But not in a model independent way, and of course.
Did you run a support vector machine to classify it from bit to bit to bit? Did you compare the error which comes out of that? This would give you a
yes. So in our UAI paper, we did precisely that. I mean, we compared the minimum information classifier with the naive base and with the some other things like linear logistic regression, which is very popular for this type of classification problem. And you can do also with support computation to give about the same thing. And we are very competitive with the best. On small samples, we do better than the log linear. We always beat the naive base, by the way. This is not that easy, by the way, in some cases. And we beat it significantly. I mean, I can show you. If you look at my web page, there is the full UAI paper. You can see the results there. Maybe I have, if you really want to see this, it's this. I have the poster here. Here it is. So this figure is a comparison of the minimum information with naive base and the log linear on this UCI dataset, which is standard test data for classification problems, and you see that the minimum information is comparable to the log linear in many cases, and it actually do better on small samples. So I don't know. This gives you some idea. What is it you want to know? Yes. I think you're right. That's a probably an important point.
But for example, the case that you presented example, we have two neurons, not two neurons, but we have like tens of neurons and eight possible directions.
No, I guess it's a valid answer, yes, please.
So, I just want to ask,
it's past 12, yeah.
When you do have observations of higher tens of neurons,
so you get immediately, so there's another figure here somewhere that I didn't show you. This is just, I asked Amir to do exactly this. He did it overnight and decided it's not nice enough to show in the talk. But this is how much you improve your bound as a function of higher order correlation. So what he did is some sort of simulation where the true distribution is conditionally independent. So this is the thing that you would like to know, but you don't know that. So the minimum information with assuming one is actually giving you very little, and then when you move to second order, then your observation actually tell you, look, this is a conditionally independent system, and you get a big jump in the information, the minimum information bound, and then it's hardly changed further on. So this actually tells you, look, if you can measure pairwise, you can get a lot of information which actually supports, let's say, the conditional independence assumption in this case. It's actually very useful to go beyond single cells. I'm not saying that if this is what the impression that I gave, this is the wrong impression.
So this formula, actually, everything applies just naturally.
That's right. Everything applies. You can do it in principle for kth order and see how much you gain by adding another order correlation. That's the point I was trying to make. More questions? All right, thank you.